From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. Retired General David Petraeus is headed to Wall Street. He'll join Kohlberg Kravis Roberts, or KKR. It's a firm that invests globally in everything from real estate to coffee to biotech. Petraeus resigned last November as director of the Central Intelligence Agency after revelations he had an extramarital affair with his biographer. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports on the four-star general's transition from public service to private equity.
Over nearly four decades in the military, David Petraeus traveled the world on diplomatic and intelligence missions. Even then, he says in a video posted today on KKR's website, he occasionally viewed these trips through an investor's lens.
To see countries that I visited and would occasionally wonder, why aren't there U.S. investors here?
Petraeus is a West Point graduate with a Ph.D. from Princeton in international relations. Before joining the CIA, he had been commander of NATO forces in Afghanistan, which culminated more than 37 years in the Army. He says he decided to join KKR because the company takes what he calls an intellectual approach to business. The company invests in many different industry sectors and in over 80 companies ranging from U.S. medical device makers to dairy farms in China and a coffee chain in India.
I think there are enormous trends that are developing around the world in energy, manufacturing, life sciences, and IT revolutions that are having far-reaching effects, and we're just beginning to see what those effects will be long-term.
In his new role, Petraeus will head the newly created KKR Global Institute, a kind of advisory arm for clients. The company says he will also advise KKR itself on international investments, an area where Petraeus has impressive contacts. Speaking in that same video, KKR co-founder Henry Kravis told Petraeus this.
By bringing you on to chair the Global Institute, what it will give us is a real advantage from an investor standpoint.
In joining a big-name Wall Street firm, Petraeus is following a well-worn path tread by many former top government officials before him. In the months following the disclosure of his affair and his resignation, Petraeus had kept out of the public eye, working on helping veterans find employment. Finally, in late March, Petraeus broke his silence. Speaking to an audience of veterans at the University of Southern California, he acknowledged he's still working to rebuild the public's faith in him.
I join you keenly aware that I am regarded in a different light now than I was a year ago.
Petraeus apologized for causing pain to his family and supporters. He is perhaps best known for championing a counterinsurgency strategy in Iraq that involved winning hearts and minds. When he retired from the military 3 years ago, he had this advice.
We don't always get to fight the wars for which we're most prepared or most inclined.
In other words, the best laid plans sometimes lead to unexpected places, so one must adapt. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Joining us now is Flora Lichtman with our video pick of the week. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
We got something really special this week.
It is special. We're turning the spotlight on an underrepresented, under-celebrated, you might say, group, science teachers.
Science teachers.
I don't think we're in danger of over-celebrating them, so let's go with that. And the tip came from our very own Christopher Intagliata, associate senior producer here, who told me one day that his teacher in college, Tom Carlson, who's a botanist and a medical doctor, had a really profound impact on Chris's life. And so I thought, since we were going out to California, it might be fun to pressure Chris into having an awkward conversation, telling Carlson how important that experience was.
I took your medical ethnobotany course in my summer after my freshman year.
Right.
In that year, I'd been taking a lot of weird classes, African drumming, poetry. And then I took your class, and it sort of woke me up. We were always trailing after you in the garden, the botanical garden.
So let's walk through here a little bit.
Once a week, I think, we went around the garden, and you explained things about different species and what they were used for.
Anybody know what this bark is right here? This is cork, Corcus suber. Oh, look at this. Look at the hummingbird there, the ruby throat. It's getting nectar out of a species of salvia. Oh, my gosh. Oh.
I remember one day we were walking around the garden.
Right.
And it just turned this light bulb on in my head. You don't have to be in school to see this stuff.
Right.
And it made me think, I want to be a biologist. I want to study biology. And that was a huge revelation for me, and I know also some of the other students, and it inspired me a lot.
Well, that's amazing to hear. And look what you're doing now. It's you're communicating about science to people all over in very expansive ways. And you're not the only one that gets inspired. I get inspired, and I get energized. It sustains me just to see how your wings are open and you're flying in ways that put a fire in your belly. One thing I tell students, it's very important, whatever subjects or career you're going toward, select something that puts a fire in your belly. And it's not that every hour of every day of work is going to be enjoyable. There's always can be difficult times, but you want to select something that you really love. And clearly,
I think you helped me do that. Yeah.
You've clearly done that, and so this is that's what we're here for. That's what we want to do.
Wow, I wish I had a professor like that.
Don't we all? Well, if you do, actually, if you're a listener and you do have a professor like that, we're trying to make this page on our website the feel-good destination of the week on the interwebs. Just leave us a story about it. And if you'd like to meet the man, the myth, the legend, Tom Carlson of UC Berkeley, that's what our video pick is. It's a spotlight of him.
There it is, up on our website this week. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
That's about all the time we have for today. Our senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berkowitz is our director. Flora Lichtman is our correspondent and managing editor for video. Our associate senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Sam Plato was our production assistant. Eli Chen, our assistant producer. Neil Rauch, our technical director, spinning the dials here in New York. Note for you in Seattle, if you're in Seattle, come and see us. We're going to be at the Pacific Science Center on June 14th. You can get more info at our website at sciencefriday.com/Pacific. We'll be out there on June 14th at the Pacific Science Center. Come and watch the show, sit in the audience, and partake of the program with us. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
Darius Rucker, formerly known as Hootie of the band Hootie and the Blowfish, is on his own these days, making waves in the world of country music.
Church bells ringing on our wedding day. Climbed in that limo and I rode away. Guess you'll always hear some people say.
His third album was just released last week. It's called True Believers.
We are one.
Darius Rucker's on tour now, and he joins us from Simpsonville, South Carolina. Darius Rucker, welcome to the show.
Hey, Wade, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great. True Believers is your third country music album, and it's also the name of the title track. Is a inspiring song, I would say. This is your third country album. You know, how would you rate it compared to the other two?
Oh, I think it's the best record I've ever made.
You're more pleased.
Yeah, I love the other two records, but this record I was head over heels for. I just thought we had really hit it out of the park. We had done exactly what I wanted to do, what I needed to do for my career, and I was just really excited about it.
You know, the track that really impressed me was the next track called Miss You, which is sung from the perspective of a husband who is in bed with his wife and she's gone to sleep.
Laid down in this big old bed and you've turned on the TV. Fell asleep without a good night kiss.
And he remembers a time when they would never go to sleep without first kissing each other and hugging each other. But those days are over and he regrets it.
Oh yeah, that's all. I think everybody who's been in a relationship for a long time can relate to that song. Well, I've had people already come up to me and go, man, you really made me and my wife think about our relationship. And I was like, that's what I wanted to do.
How did we get here? Well, you can be right there and I can be with you. And miss you.
you know, I know this is a question everyone asks you about, which is crossing over from pop to country. And is this a return to your roots? I mean, what was the motivation behind this? Were you coming home?
Yeah, it was country music. You know, I've been saying I was going to make a country record since 1989, saying it for so long, and it was just time to do it. So it was. It's definitely a comeback to the South. You know, come back to where I was born and raised.
Was race ever an issue?
I never thought about it. You know, it's something I never really thought about until I started having hits. Like when "Don't Think I Don't Think About It" started to become a hit, and people started talking about, you know, being the first African American in 25 years to have a hit on the charts. I was shocked. It's not an issue for me. I just want to play, you know, the music I want to play.
Well, this album may be country, but as I listen to it, it's kind of Darius Rucker country. I mean, you're rocking out here pretty good.
Yeah, you know, that's the one thing that we realized, no matter what we did, it was going to sound like Darius Rucker. I like to, you know, give people something to dance to, something to turn it up loud and listen to. And so that's what we try to do with every record. I'm glad I'm not trying to be anything but myself, you know, and so I'm playing the Darius Rucker brand of country, and people are accepting it.
You have a version of a song by Old Crow Medicine Show that's taking off right now. It's called "A Wagon Wheel," and it's at the top of the country Billboard chart. So let's hear a bit of it.
Heading down south to the land of the pines, I'm thumbing my way into North Carolina, staring up the road and pray to God I see headlights. I made it down the coast in 17 hours, picking me a bouquet of dogwood flowers, and I'm hoping for Riley, I can see my baby tonight. So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock me, mama, any way you feel. Hey, mama, rock me.
What was it about this song that inspired you to cover it?
It's such a great tune, and I never even think about cutting that song until I heard it one day at my oldest daughter's high school talent show, and the faculty band got up and played it. They did such a great country version of it that just blew me away. I was like, wow, I never even thought of that song as a country song, but it's a great country song.
I'm running from the cold up in New England. I was born to be a fiddler in an old-time string band. My baby plays the guitar, I pick a banjo now. Country winners keep a-getting me down. Lost my money playing poker, so I had to leave town. But I ain't a-turning back to living that old life no more.
So I wanted to cut it, and then I've got Lady Antebellum to sing on it, and that took it to a whole new level. And it just seemed to be the perfect thing for me to do.
This album has a range of styles within the country genre. Was that your intention to begin with, or is that simply something you ended up with at the end of the process?
I think, you know, when we're making records, the most important thing to me is always the songs. I don't really think about the styles. I just want to have a lot of great songs that you can put out. And then we were lucky with this record that the songs that came to the floated to the top also had different styles to them. And so it was, once we finished, I was really proud of how many different styles of country music, and that's always a good thing to me.
And at the beginning of one song, you have a little boogie-woogie piano, I think.
Oh, yeah, Take Me Home. That's really cool to have. Just that's another style of music that I love. And it's really cool to have that on my record. When we started cutting that song and I heard the big piano that Gordon Moat was playing, I was like, man, that's awesome.
I wanted more.
Hell, me too.
I want to hear a southern drawl and taste every word that lingers. I need a Sunday morning song by a just got baptized singer. I've been away too long. Somebody take me home.
The other song that I really like is Radio, which is a roll down your windows, turn the radio up loud, and drive 20 miles an hour too fast, and let her rip.
It is one of those big summer songs where you just turn up the put the windows down to get your friends in the car and drive and just sing along. I love that tune.
And I thought maybe I heard an echo of Wall of Voodoo song, Mexican Radio.
That's exactly what we were going for when we did that. And I'm on a Mexican radio.
You nailed it, because the way they say radio and the way you say radio is exactly the same.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was going for.
I hear rumors of a Hootie and the Blowfish reunion next year. You want to give us a scoop?
You know, we're talking about it. We're talking about doing some shows.
Now, Darius, you know, this is National Public Radio, so this is a good place to break news if you'd like to.
Oh, I got nothing to break. We're still just talking about it, man. I mean, we haven't even, you know, I don't think the four of us have even gotten together. We've just been sending emails that, you know, we might want to do something next year, but no one's got anything written in stone.
Darius Rucker, thanks so much for coming on the show, and good luck.
Thank you, Wade. Good talking to you.
You got the keys, girl. I'm just a rider. Gas it up and get us out of here.
And for Saturday, that's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Wade Goodwin. Check out our weekly podcast. Search for Weekends on All Things Considered on iTunes or on the NPR smartphone app. Clip on programs and scroll down. We're back on the radio tomorrow. Until then, thanks for listening and have a good night.
Summer vacation is nearly upon us, the perfect time for kids of all ages to fall under the spell of a good book. Mara Alpert is a children's librarian for the Los Angeles Public Library. She joined me with a stack of some of her favorite new books. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's begin with a book for very young children. This book involves portraits by very well-known artists like Pablo Picasso and Chuck Close. It's called Faces for Baby. 12 more works by famous artists to explore with your child.
Well, it's pretty well known that young children like to look at faces. And it's also pretty well known that a lot of parents would love their children to start becoming interested in art just as soon as possible. So this is a book that speaks to both of those things, because the baby can look at the beautiful pictures of faces, the beautiful artwork, and then the parents can take the kid to the museum and say, let's look for paintings that have faces. Let's look for sculptures. And then in the very back, of course, there is a mirror so that the baby can look at their own face.
Oh, I just opened up and there's a shiny big mirror.
And you could actually use this with older children too, because a lot of these pictures are very kid-friendly. A child would look at it and say, I could do that. You could then pull out the crayons and say, great, let's make our own portraits, our own self-portraits.
From human faces to a book focused on the animal world. The book is called My First Day, What Animals Do on Day One.
This one's particularly interesting because we can't remember what our first day on Earth was like. Our mom might be able to tell us, but we don't remember that. And different animals in the animal kingdom, they have very different experiences. Some are born and they are moving, and some need a lot of care the way that human babies do. And it's just really interesting, all the different experiences.
Pick one. There's so many.
This is the kiwi, which is not a fruit, but a bird. On my first day, I spent hours kicking my way out of my egg. As soon as I hatched, I was ready to take care of myself. And then we look at the Siberian tiger. But I was helpless. I couldn't even open my eyes. My mother cleaned me, fed me, and kept me safe.
And then a completely different way of coming out is the emperor penguin. On my first day, it was cold. I climbed out of my egg,
stood on my father's feet, and snuggled into his feathers to stay warm. And it's such a sweet picture.
One that involves a father, not a mother.
Right. And there's actually another father one, which is Darwin's frog. On my first day, I hopped out of my father's mouth. When I was a tadpole, he kept me safe in a special pouch in his throat. But once I became a frog, it was time to be on my own. Ew.
But it's the most surreal picture. You're looking straight at a big frog, and a little frog is coming out of his mouth.
Yes.
Now, you brought in a book that is a book of poems based on very well-known fairy tales, but it is a most unusual way of telling those tales. It's called Follow, Follow, a book of reverso poems.
And it was written by Marilyn Singer and illustrated by José Massey. It tells the story from two different viewpoints. So, for instance, the story of the emperor's new clothes, if you read the verse from beginning to end, it is the emperor talking. And the exact same words read in the other direction, it is the little boy talking.
Let's read the one about the emperor's new clothes. It's called Birthday Suit. And illustrated by an emperor looking at himself in the mirror, seeing himself dressed up very beautifully in fancy new suit, and a little boy peering around the mirror, seeing him, well, not quite naked, in his underwear.
And it starts with His Majesty. Behold His Glorious Majesty, me. Who dares say he drained the treasury on nothing? Ha! This emperor has sublime taste in finery. Only a fool could fail to see.
Here I go, the little boy. Only a fool could fail to see sublime taste in finery. This emperor has, ha, nothing on. Who dares say he drained the treasury? Me. Behold His Glorious Majesty. What's amazing about this is it's not just a story told in reverse. The same lines are read in reverse.
Yes, and it tells the story from two completely opposite viewpoints.
This is so interactive. I would think to send somebody off to a pencil and paper or the computer and try and do their own version.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And also to send them to their bedroom to find the collection of fairy tales and folklore, or to the library, or to the bookstore.
So what else have you brought?
Well, the story of Elizabeth Blackwell, Who Says Women Can't Be Doctors, by Tanya Lee Stone, illustrated by Marjorie Priceman, who I love her illustrations. They are so quirky. And the story of Elizabeth Blackwell is very interesting because she didn't actually set out to do anything special. She decided to try to become a doctor. And so?
But you say she didn't set out to do anything special, except that it was the early 1800s.
Yes. And everyone said, women aren't smart enough. And people laughed at her. And so she applied to many, many medical schools. And they all sent back the same answer, no. And then one day, she got a yes. And the reason she got a yes was that the students thought it was a joke.
And figured she'd fail.
And they figured she'd fail. And she ended up being top in her class when she graduated in 1849.
Well, I think it's important to maybe describe a little bit how this is illustrated. It's done in a way that's quite jolly.
It's almost comic and very fun. For instance, the picture where Elizabeth is proving she's smart as any boy, and so the other male students are sort of hanging around with her, and then there's a picture of a very sour-faced woman hiding the eyes of her impressionable daughter because she shouldn't be seeing, you know, a woman like that, who's doing something so outrageous.
Mara Alpert, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mara Alpert is a children's librarian for the L.A. Public Library, and her recommendations are at NPR.org. From NPR News, this is Morning Edition. The engineering manager is Kevin Langley. Our technical director, Kurt Stalnaker. Our audio engineers include Stacey Abbott, Elizabeth Ackley, Zachary Coleman, Brian Jarbo, Dennis Nielsen, Ted Mebane, Greg Gavin, Jerry Tennant, Michael Cullen, Melissa Marquis, Renee Pringle, and Neil Tivolt, with Marcia Caldwell, Theo Mondel, Patrick Murray, and Leo Delagula at NPR West. Morning Edition's theme music was written by BJ Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm Renee Montaigne.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Historian Mary Louise Roberts says she's written a book that can make our memories of the Second World War, the good war, as we often think of it, more truthful and more complex. Her book is called What Soldiers Do, Sex and the American GI in World War II France. It's a story of relations between American men and French women in Normandy and elsewhere. The Americans were liberators, the French were liberated, but sex created tensions and resentments that were serious and were utterly absent from contemporary accounts for American audiences back home.
With the streets cleared, the victors formally enter the city. Everyone gathers for a joyful liberation celebration. Yanks and French join in the celebration. Here's a French Betsy Ross. The children have made American flags from paper, coloring them with watercolors. They've learned a song to honor our boys.
Like a
Mary Louise Roberts, who's professor of European history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
To the program. And to put it mildly, it wasn't entirely grateful Normans and respectful GIs in liberated Normandy.
I think it's a matter of chronology. I think that initially the Normans were incredibly grateful to be liberated. They had also suffered a lot of loss that summer. So there was some anger about the destruction of their homes and the loss of their loved ones. But in general, at least at the beginning, the French were very happy to be liberated and to greet the Americans.
Then you report complaints by, say, the mayor of Havre, who's complaining about American GIs having sex in public with French prostitutes, so much so that a family can't take children out for a walk anymore.
Yes, that happened in the summer of 1945, so a year later. Le Havre was a port, really the entry and exit port for millions of American soldiers during those years. Those soldiers who had been fighting in France and Germany came back to Le Havre waiting for a boat home. They were, as a group, exhausted and traumatized. Their lost friends crowded their dreams. They were consumed by guilt. So they took to whoring with French women as a way to keep away the demons, at least for a while. And without a proper or regulated system of brothels, they instead took to the streets, abandoned buildings, parks, and cemeteries, having sex.
Your title, What Soldiers Do, implies that hundreds of thousands of men far from home flirting with death have sex with prostitutes. But you also write, sex was fundamental to how the U.S. military framed, fought, and won the war in Europe. Which was it, the behavior of the universal soldier or something unique to that army in that place?
It was a particularly eroticized war. Anybody who remembers the pinups on airplanes, Rita Hayworth, the amount to which pinups became a part of the culture of the GIs, will recognize to what extent sex became important to the war experience. I went and looked at Stars and Stripes, which is the trench journal. And what I saw there was an extension of the pinup culture. Photojournalism in particular was used to portray the French woman as ready to be rescued, ready to greet the American soldier, and ready to congratulate and thank him through a kiss or even more.
And as the Americans were multiplying in force in Normandy, young French women came from all over the country to prostitute themselves.
Yes, that's true. I would have to say that prostitution was pervasive in the European theater. There was one army report that estimated 80% of single men and 50% of married men would have sex during their stay in Europe. And the U.S. military did not really care that much that it occurred. What it cared about was venereal disease, mm-hmm. which soon after the GI's arrivals in France began to soar to unacceptable levels. But all this was kept from the American public.
The other issue you address is rape. In the summer of 1944, mm-hmm. you're right, there was in Normandy a wave of rape accusations by French women against American soldiers. And the U.S. Army's response, as you recounted, was to frame it essentially as a race problem. I want you to describe what happened.
What happened was the American Army and the juridical system attached to the Army, the JAG office, disproportionately blamed African-American soldiers. 77% of the court-martial prosecutions in the European theater were for African-Americans. They were only 10% of the troops.
We're talking, though, about trials that would take place almost instantly after an accusation.
Yes, sometimes 3 days afterwards.
And then there were quite a few summary executions by hanging.
That's right. Many of the men were hung in the towns where the alleged rape occurred. And the hanging was a difficult thing to do in the land of the guillotine. So the U.S. Army actually brought in their own hangman from Texas. I found a file in the National Archives which dealt with this.
Yes, he came with his ropes from...
He came with his rope, yes.
From over the
grisly,
seas.
Very grisly.
I mean, what you've done here is you've described the liberation of France, not from the perspective we're accustomed to seeing it told from. This is from the perspective of the French.
Yes.
And a very female perspective as well of what's going on. And the war comes out a lot more nuanced in terms of its virtues after we read your book. How do you as a historian integrate your sense of this heroic crossing of the English Channel, one of the most greatest military exercises in human history, and the perhaps inevitable behavior of the troops once they were in France?
Well, I guess like many people, I was somewhat surprised when I found out that the GIs were not impeccable soldiers. I began to look at documents in France that were only opened in January of 2005, and in many cases, I was the first American to look at them. I grew up in a very patriotic family. My father is a veteran of the Second World War. So all this was difficult for me. But I actually also have to say that there's nothing in my book that tries to condemn or denigrate that great moment. What I'm trying to do is give a fuller picture by looking at how the event was seen by the French to make it richer and more complex. And to me, really good history portrays an event not in a sanitized way, but as a way in which you can allow yourself to think of soldiers as human beings.
Lou Roberts, Mary Louise Roberts, thanks a lot for talking with us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Professor Roberts' book is called What Soldiers Do, Sex and the American GI in World War II France.
Now let's take a look at another impact on forests. Paper, including the smallest items like tissue paper or the wrapper on a drinking straw, can lead to the destruction of tropical forests. Environmentalists have long pressured big corporations to change their ways. And for today's Business Bottom Line, NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Jakarta on how one of the world's biggest paper companies that was cutting virgin forests to create tree plantations did decide to reverse its practices on deforestation.
Asia Pulp and Paper, or APP, is Indonesia's largest paper maker. It sold billions of dollars worth of paper products to Staples, Disney, and other big U.S. corporations. But environmental groups have accused APP of causing deforestation, destroying the habitat of Sumatran tigers and orangutans, and trampling on the rights of forest dwellers. On the island of Sumatra, a backhoe stacks freshly cut trees to be made into pulp and paper. APP and its suppliers operate vast plantations of acacia trees here that have transformed the local landscape. Azriel Amran is the head of a nearby village. He claims that the plantations have ruined the local environment.
In the past, we could go into the forest and catch deer. We could look for birds. But now, there is nothing, as you can see. No animal can live in the acacia forest. We cannot shelter in its shade. It's hot. It's a greedy tree. It uses up a lot of water.
2 years ago, the environmental group Greenpeace began targeting APP's biggest customers.
We're here today to send a clear message to Mattel executives, the people behind me in this
They protested at the Los Angeles headquarters of Mattel, makers of the Barbie doll. In this campaign video, Barbie's boyfriend, Ken, learns that Barbie's packaging is causing deforestation. That's totally uncool, so he dumps her. Barbie sits on her couch in a huff, wearing her Day-Glow spandex.
I'm Barbie. As long as I look good, who cares about tigers in some distant rainforest? If Mattel wants to use wood from Indonesia's rainforest to make my box, then let them do it.
The campaign and others like it worked. Companies stopped buying APP's products and APP's profits plummeted. APP felt the criticism was unfair. After all, they said, they were building schools and conservation programs for local communities. Ida Greenberry is in charge of sustainability for APP. She admits they felt a bit cornered.
Before, when we were attacked, we only saw headlines, forest criminal, destruction of forest. We didn't see the way out.
So APP turned to Scott Poynton, a lanky Australian who runs the Tropical Forest Trust. Poynton told them bluntly that if they kept cutting down virgin forests, no amount of greenwashing was going to help them.
I was pissed off. I was just thought, you guys are not listening. Your whole business is going down the drain. You've got customers leaving you every 2 seconds. You think you're doing a good job and you've missed the point.
Poynton put this in a scathing report to APP. To drive home his point, he included a poem about owning up to one's mistakes. Ida Greenberry read it.
I did a lot of swearing when I read it, but but it was needed.
Greenpeace and Poynton's good cop, bad cop tactics worked. In February, APP's chairman announced that his company would stop cutting down natural forests. Poynton says that APP's managers are not evil people. They just needed help in seeing that their business model was outdated.
The context in which they're operating has changed, and with questions of climate change, cutting down forests is not cool, and people don't want deforestation in their products.
Environmentalists say the APP case shows the importance of big corporations in driving deforestation and stopping it. Lafcadio Cortesi is an activist with the Rainforest Action Network.
Sure, consumers want stuff, they use stuff, but the corporations are the ones that determine often or try to influence what you perceive that you need and what you perceive are the things that you want to buy. And so that's one of the reasons that we focus on large corporate consumers rather than individuals.
Greenpeace Indonesia activist Yuyun Indradi welcomes APP's new policy. But he says that if APP goes back on its pledge, Greenpeace will restart its campaign. He adds that APP is only the first step in a bigger fight against deforestation.
Our target is zero deforestation in Indonesia by 2015. Yes, I think it's quite ambitious, but APP's pledge helps to lighten our burden in reaching that goal.
He says Greenpeace is now trying to persuade other papermakers to follow APP's example. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Jakarta.